deficiency in anemia.
So, tell me, what's the most common symptom of anemia?
Fatigue.
Yeah, fatigue, tiredness, right? It's a very vague symptom. A lot of people have it. A lot of people have anemia. Right? And so when we look at people with anemia and fatigue, we really want to sort of figure out where they stand and what the cause of it is. So obviously this easy thing you do is you get a CBC, which is usually how you find out they're anemic, right? Their hemoglobin's low, their hematocrit's low. But on the CBC, you get several other things. You get MCV, MCHC, and those. So in iron deficiency anemia, what's your MCV? Low, normal, or high?
Corpuscular volume, lean corpuscular volume. It's a normal acidic. Is it normal acidic? Or is it
microacidic? Is iron deficiency anemia microacidic, normal acidic, or macroacidic?
Microacidic.
Okay. So your MCV is low. Sorry.
That's okay.
So iron deficiency is microacidic. You lack iron, which means you're going to not be able to make as much heme. So your cells are going to be low in volume, so your mean corpuscle volume is going to be low. Okay. With certain other anemias, you're going to have a macrocytic anemia. Give me examples.
B12?
What's it called? Okay, so B12 deficiency, what up?
Not pernicious.
Pernicious anemia is also macrocytic.
Is it macrocytic?
Yeah. And then some of the other ones are normocytic. Anemia chronic disease can be normocytic. Acute blood loss anemia is normocytic, right? Some thalassemia can be normocytic. And then sickle cell anemia, what's the hallmark of sickle cell anemia?
Shape in red blood cells?
Yeah, so you have the sickle-shaped red blood cells on peripheral smear, and it's not so much the MCV, but the RDW that's going to be high, your red cell distribution width, because there's variability in shape and size, right? So that happens when you have a high retic count, which means your body's trying to replace the blood loss, your RDW goes up. It goes up when the cells aren't homogeneous. So if you've got a sickle cell or spherocytosis or some of those things, it goes up. Essentially, they all will give you weakness and fatigue as symptoms, right? More so with acute blood loss anemia. Those are probably going to be the most symptomatic because you have no time to compensate. One of the questions that always comes up with anemia is how should you correct it? So obviously number one thing is you want to find the cause and correct the cause. If they're iron deficient, well, give them iron. Now you can be iron deficiency anemia from chronic bleeding, right? So it's not just low iron intake, but if you, for example, have menorrhagia, if you have a GI bleed, you know, very slow bleeding, you have ulcers that tend to lose little bits of blood. You might not really notice it or appreciate the volume, but those things add up, and so common causes of iron deficiency anemia are chronic blood loss. Things like that. Okay. We generally look at correction, and we used to say everybody should be corrected to 10. Right? Hemoglobin should be over 10. Just if you're anemic, you're in the hospital. You're anemic. We give you blood until you're corrected to 10. And there is a big trial that looked at blood transfusions and whether or not you should transfuse blood. And there's a few issues with giving blood transfusion to correct anemia, right? One is obviously the risk of bloodborne infections, which we screen for and it's fairly safe, but nevertheless, it's there. The second is getting the wrong blood type or having a blood reaction or having a reaction to the antibodies in the blood, right? And that's why you do your blood typing and cross-matching and stuff, but you can still have reactions to things that don't get cross-matched for. And then lastly, it's blood is essentially immunosuppressive. Okay? So it causes people to have a diminished immune system response. So if you're giving it to septic patients or patients with infectious diseases, they can get worse. Cancer patients can do poorly when you give blood to everybody, pretty much. Blood transfusions are associated with higher mortality. The argument that you'll hear is, well, people who need more blood are sick, so they're going to die, right? Makes sense. So higher mortality is an association, not a causation. So someone did a trial, and they looked at liberal versus restrictive blood transfusions. And a liberal blood transfusion protocol was everybody got transfused until their hemoglobin was 10 or higher. And a conservative blood transfusion protocol was everyone got transfused to a hemoglobin of 7 or higher, unless they were symptomatic or hypotensive or something while their hemoglobin was 7, in which case they would get transfused until they were not symptomatic, okay, or 210. So they looked at this and they looked at the outcomes, and essentially mortality is lower in the conservative blood transfusion group than the others because more blood has its associated side effects, which then causes more complications.
Why is that?
That group excluded cardiac patients though. Okay? So this is why you'll hear, oh, it's a cardiac patient, go to 10. Because they excluded patients with heart disease and stuff. Because imagine someone's got a bad heart and you're going to not give them the oxygen carrying capacity. They might have an MI. So it was a population that was excluded from the study because they didn't want to have a problem with that population. So we don't know if that data applies to them. So you can't apply the data to them. Why is it that their mortality is higher? Because blood is immunosuppressive for one thing.
Well, why
it causes
it?
Well, because we don't really know the exact mechanisms, but it may have to do with the fact that you've got immune cells in the blood, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the donor, and so they're gonna try to attack your cells in your immune system, and that immune system are gonna be battling each other. It's not a big effect. It's not like a graft versus host, right? Because it's really mostly packed red cells and not a lot of the other stuff. But again, it's not normal substances that are in your own blood, so it does tend to have that effect for some reason. And what was I talking about?
Heart
patients, right? So they're excluded from this population because of their associated risk, so people still are pretty aggressive with giving them blood. Some neuro patients, people argue, need more blood if they've got brain injuries because you need to maintain oxygenation and perfusion. And obviously, if you've got a hypotensive patient or someone with ongoing bleeding or whatnot, you need to transfuse them liberally. But the idea is giving more blood doesn't necessarily mean better outcomes. The other thing is more blood causes more volume issues, so you can go to CHF. Blood is associated with trolley or transfusion-related acute lung injury, right, which is basically an ARDS-type picture that follows a blood transfusion. Again, that immunogenic response or reaction towards your tissues. And so there's a lot of downsides potentially to blood transfusions. In outpatient settings, you really don't have to deal with that so much because patients are usually stable and minimally symptomatic, so you slowly correct them. And so if they're iron deficient, you want to give them iron. In sickle cell patients, you just need to avoid things that cause sickle cell crisis, which is like hypoxemia, altitude, and those kinds of things. There isn't much you can do other than symptom control and relief. Sickle cell is a very, very, very painful disease. They, in fact, can infarct their spleen, and so that's very painful, and they'll have an atrophied, infarcted spleen. You don't have to do anything about that.
You don't do a splenectomy?
You don't have to. It basically infarcts and involutes and shrivels up most of the time. If it's very painful for them and they can't handle it, sometimes they do, but a lot of them, it just infarcts on its own. The B12 or folate deficiencies you replace, you know, pernicious anemia is a difficult situation because they're lacking intrinsic factor to absorb the B12, so you might have to give them B12 shots instead of oral supplementation and stuff. Big problem in gastric bypass patients, for example, because things are going the other direction. Okay, so clotting factor disorders. Let's talk about that.
Before we move on, do you mind if we go over a little bit of the labs that, like, the TIBC we were kind of wondering about, and like what will be high, what will be low?
Like for iron deficiency anemia?
Yeah, so we have the.
So when you do iron studies, you're going to get your iron level. So initially on your CBC, you're going to have your MCV, which is your biggest thing. It's going to be low. And normal is 80 to 100. So an iron deficiency anemia, you're going to be usually in the high 70s or low. And then you can get your iron studies, which is your iron, TIBC, and ferritin. So your iron is obviously going to be low. Your TIBC will be usually high. So that's your total iron binding capacity, because your body's trying to compensate by creating more binding protein to increase your iron stores. Except there is no iron to bind to, so your iron is low and your total capacity is going to be high. That's usually the easiest way to remember that.
And then the ferritin?
Ferritin, I think, in iron deficiency is normal. Is it? I don't know. Look that one up. I don't remember ferritin exactly.
Okay. And what exactly is ferritin again?
Ferritin, I think, is another iron binding.
Ferritin isn't a measure of your stored iron?
It's the bound iron, right? Or stored iron. I don't know.
Is an intracellular protein that stores iron and releases it.
It's like your bound or stored iron. Now, for thalassemia, so this is something that I'm not very good at this, but you should look it up. There's a very good way of looking at the proportions of your MCV, MCHC, and your hemoglobin and stuff, and figuring out which type of anemia they have. Like, is it going to be thalassemia, beta thal, alpha thal?
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about. Like, how do you look at that?
I don't know it off the top of my head, because I don't really do that very much, but the medicine people do that a lot. So I'm sure if you Google it, there's a little chart on what the best way to tell those apart is. Okay, so let's talk about clotting factor disorder. So give me some of the common clotting factor disorders. Okay, which is a deficiency in what factor? Okay, give me another one.
Oh, sorry.
Good.
Did you point it to somebody?
That's fine. Hemophilia B is a deficiency in what?
Clotting factor 11 or 9?
9.
9.
8 and 9. What else?
The infection, Gale's blood test.
Good. Von Willebrand's is a clotting disorder. It's not a clotting factor issue, but it is a clotting disorder. It's a bleeding disorder. types of bonbo brands. There's where you make no bonbo brands, you make defective bonbo brands, or you make low but normal bonbo brands. Okay. And so the distinction is in the ones where you make low or normal, I mean low but normal amounts, you can give DDAVP, which increases their binding and will kind of correct. But for the patient who makes none or makes defective ones, they will not correct because more of the not working von Willebrand's factor won't help. Okay. Let's see here. So factor 8 and factor 9 are associated with hemophilia. They're big bleeding disorders. Factor 8 is probably the most labile factor, which means in stored blood, it drops its levels very quickly. So, with that said, for hemophilia A, you can give cryoprecipitate, which is rich in fibrinogen, von Willebrand's, and factor 8. But giving, let's say, fresh frozen plasma won't really be helpful because it's such a labile factor. The reason it's labile is because factor 8 is broken down by... Factor 8 gets broken down by...
Is that C?
Yeah, it's protein C, and then S is the cofactor for protein C. So because you have protein C in the blood that's stored, protein C is going to break down all the factor 8. And so factor 8 doesn't store very well. But in cryoprecipitate, you have just the factor 8, von Willebrand's, and fibrinogen mainly. And so you have higher levels. You can also get factor 8 concentrates and get that as well as factor 9 and other factors. They're harder to get and more expensive sometimes. But you can do that. So that's... cryoprecipitate is something you can use to treat DIC, which is going to be low in fibrinogen. You can treat diseases that have problems with von Willebrand's and hemophilia. Okay. And essentially, for hemophilia A, you're just going to replace them to 50% of normal levels. And hemophilia B, you replace them to 100% of normal levels, basically. It has to do with the way they work in the cascade. You really only need about half of your normal levels to be able to make a functional cascade if you have a factor 8, but you need pretty much the normal amount of factor 9 to be able to have a functional cascade. Okay, and then hypercoagulable states, name a few. So factor 5, what is that? What's the problem in factor 5 bleeding?
Is it that it can't be inactivated by the protein C?
Yeah, that's abnormal factor 5, right? And then factor 5 is a normal, you become hypercoagulable.
Okay.
But when it's normal, it is part of the cascade. But if, when it becomes abnormal, it doesn't function, right? It's, it can't be inactivated, like you said. So then it continuously, it promotes coagulation. But it's not a procoagulant factor, right? I mean, it's a procoagulant factor. When it becomes abnormal, it can't be inactivated.
Okay.
Protein C and protein S are anticoagulants, essentially. Right, they're natural inhibitors or mechanisms to undo the clotting cascade. The problem is with protein C and S deficiency, if you're deficient in them, the system will then run without having a check, and so you're hypercoagulable when you have a deficiency in protein C and S. Make sense? Factor V laden tends to, for some reason, have a lot of arterial thrombus, whereas protein CNS patients tend to have venous thrombuses. So more so DVTs versus factor V patient people getting like arterial occlusions and ischemic limbs and stuff. And how do you treat them? They're clotting too much. Make them stop. What's the oldest and cheapest? Aspirin is an anti what?
Platelet.
Yeah. Right. It's not an anticoagulant.
Heparin or warfarin.
So warfarin is cheap and you know rat poison. You can get it in buckets. Okay. You guys know what warfarin gets its name from? Oh, did I tell you already?
I'm gonna go ahead and make a guess here.
Go ahead.
The war, there's a lot of bleeding.
No. It's WARF. W-A-R-F. Oh. WARF.
Hi.
Right.
Ooh, the shop's up. I'll take it.
Okay, so, warfarin is, comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. And they basically found out that if you give this stuff to rats, they hemorrhage in their brain and die. You know, great rat poison. And then they figured out why it works and said, oh, we can use this in here. Titrate to the right amount of poison, and then they'll hopefully not bleed to death in their heads, which is what happens when people have too much coumadin. Right? They spontaneously bleed. With intracranial hemorrhages, intra-abdominal hemorrhage, or anywhere, everything just bleeds. They bump into a table and then they start bleeding. Or they get in a car accident and they hemorrhage. Yeah, but that's that, or you know, heparin or Lovenox can all be used as good anticoagulant efforts. Now there's all these new drugs that are approved for this function, but I'm sure people are going to try to use them for this. Let's see if we can get some urology stuff done too. Trying to hit the high topics here. Okay, so BPH, what is it? Big prostate, right? What happens with age predominantly? Does it affect men or women? 100%. Is it cancerous? But in a large prostate, you have to make sure it's not a prostate cancer. But what is it, what's the typical symptom of an enlarged prostate? So frequency, weak flow, feeling like you're not completely empty, right? And weak streams. Prostate cancer can have some of the same symptoms, but doesn't necessarily cause the obstructive symptoms as much. So that's another thing. A big prostate that's not causing obstructive symptoms kind of more problematic. Do you do PSA for screening for prostate cancer? Not specific. Okay, so you guys should remember this. PSA is specific to prostate, but not specific to prostate cancer. It goes up with prostatitis or inflammation or infection of the prostate. Basically, anything where there is irritation or enlargement of the prostate, there's more prostate tissue, there's more PSA. PSA is great for following patients who have prostate cancer. So if they start off with high PSA, for example, and then they get radiation or something and their prostate shrivels up and their PSA drops, then you can use that number as an annual monitoring. And if it starts going back up, then you gotta think, okay, maybe something's coming back and we have to do more testing, like a PET scan or whatnot. Okay. So it's a tumor marker, but it's not a screening test for prostate cancer. What's the screening test for prostate cancer? Index finger. Okay? You get an annual exam and you check for prostate enlargement and your history of prostate issues and those kinds of things. Urinary tract infections, more common in why? So theoretically because of a shorter urethra and potentially because of the angle in which it connects, tends to have more reverse flow. Typical symptoms of a UTI are? So burning with urination, but also sometimes abdominal pain, suprapubic pain, frequency, urgency. And treatment in the outpatient setting is first line treatment.
Bactrim
DS, twice a day for 3 days, okay, is the uncomplicated community-acquired UTI. If you have complicated UTI, such as associated with a Foley catheter or something, then a CIPRA. What about in a pregnant patient? Can you give Bactrim? Can you give CIPRA? Or quinolones? No. So what do you give them?
Yes.
Yeah, nitrofurantoin, right? So, that's the treatment.
We're going to order it, but sometimes CIPRA's lost.
Very common UTI.
So he has a copy of it.
It's also a little common in newborns.
You put them on for next Thursday.
And then that's why you have to wipe front to back and not back to front, hygiene and all the other things that go with it. Some of the things that can happen in patients who get UTIs or complications of UTIs can be what? We just called what? Perfect. What else?
Can it cause scar tissue?
Like urethritis or something? Not from a UTI, really.
Sepsis?
No,
that's complicated.
What is it? Sepsis?
Sepsis?
Yes, so you can get sepsis. What else? Okay. You can get cystitis. Just go up the anatomy, up the kidney, and generally the treatment is essentially antibiotics, unless there's an anatomic issue. If there's an anatomic problem where they're not able to clear, so if someone's getting recurrent UTIs, then you have to investigate their anatomy and find out why they're getting recurrent UTIs. Do they have an obstruction? Do they have visceral reflux? Typically common cause of recurrent UTIs in kids, okay, and those kinds of things. And then pyelonephritis is essentially infection of the kidney, treated with antibiotics. If it's really bad, you can get sepsis. Sometimes you have to drain it with a, if they get an abscess next to the kidney or something. Fair enough, like abscess or something. But that's usually from just not treating their UTI and not treating their pyelonephritis for a long time. Typical symptoms of pyelonephritis are
CDA tenderness.
Yeah, flank pain and CDA tenderness are like that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What else can cause flank pain?
Kidney stones.
Kidney stones, good. And do they have CDA tenderness? Shouldn't. Okay. And the pain usually radiates down towards the groin. And it can either pass the stone or it can get stuck and cause hydroureter. Kidney stones that are not causing swelling of the ureter and hydroureter or hydrosalpinx, which is swelling of the renal pelvis, do not cause pain. Because the pain is from the obstruction and dilation. If the stone just passes through, doesn't cause a blockage, they shouldn't have pain. What's a typical test finding in someone who has kidney stone? What test would you do? UA? Yes, and what would you see on the UA? You can strain the urine if you think they're passing stones and catch it and then test it and see what kind of stone it is. But on a standard UA, what do you see? You see blood. It'll be blood positive, right? So hematuria is common because the stone's like ripping up the urine. It's obviously not like gross hematuria. Usually it's microscopic hematuria, but it's a common cause. A common cause of it is kidney stones. What's a hydrocele? What is it? Okay, which layer? Good. And it doesn't communicate, so it doesn't drain. That's the problem. So what's the treatment for it? They don't have to do anything if it's not bothering them, but the risk of it, they're painful and they cause swollen testicles and also it predisposes to torsion. So what do you do for it? You go in, you open up the tunica, flip it over, and sew it closed the other way so that it can drain. It's not a closed sac anymore. And that way it doesn't collect again. Okay, so since I mentioned torsion, what's torsion? Okay, so the testicle twists along the axis of the splenic cord, which causes what problem? Yeah, so acute pain of the testicle, and typically the testicle is not necessarily tender, but very painful, like pain out of proportion to exam type of thing. If you get to it late, then it's a little hard, small testicle. Initially hard and swollen, then hard and small. And is that an acute problem?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a urologic emergency. It's one of two urologic emergencies. One of three. How do you diagnose it?
Okay,
you can the absence of blood flow on top. But yeah, the testicle will be elevated on that side because of the test. And one other simpler test before the radiologist comes in to do the ultrasound. So you can shine a flashlight through it. And if you have a swollen testicle that's painful and transilluminates, it's either just it doesn't transilluminate, it might be torsion. The torsion doesn't transilluminate because it's not a bag of water. Okay. And what do you do about testicular torsion once you diagnose it?
Surgery.
What kind of surgery? rush him to the operating room, emerge in there, right? And you go untwist the testicle, and then you stitch it in two sides so that it doesn't twist again. Then attach it to the scrotum so that it doesn't spin back around. So it's detorsion and then a fixation. What's epididymitis?
Inflammation of the epididymis.
Typically, it's infectious and it's treated with antibiotics. It's usually like STD related. Okay. And they also may have discharge. Diabetic ketoacidosis for critical care or acute hyperglycemia. So if a diabetic patient comes in and their blood sugar is really high, what's usually the problem? What happens to them? No. So what's wrong with having really high blood sugars acutely? We know the chronic issues, right? You get vascular problems, kidney problems, vision problems, blah, 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 blah. But why can't I just go on a really good binge today? Just have all the cake at the bakery. And then tomorrow I'll get back under control. Or I just, like, don't carry my insulin around today. So, hyperglycemia can cause coma, right? What happens in hyperglycemia is their blood sugar goes up, but they can't use any of the sugar. They have they don't have the insulin to use up that sugar. So the body can't get its energy stores. So they're going to go into ketosis typically. They're going to try to go into starvation mode and go into muscle breakdown and ketosis to use ketones as their source of energy because they can't use all the abundant glucose that's floating everywhere. But all that glucose is there, and it's very hyperosmolar, and so it causes you also to urinate a lot and get dehydrated at the same time. So they get dehydrated, they get all the osmotic effects of the fluid shifts from the hyperosmolar or hyperglycemia, and they have a lack of energy available to the rest of their body, so they're ketotic, which means they're acidotic. So typically what happens is you get hyperglycemic, and then you can get hyperglycemic non-ketoacidosis, and then you can get hyperglycemic ketoacidosis, which is diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. So in DKA, they're acidotic and they have or don't have an NAD. So you'll see their CO2 is really low, they're acidotic, so their potassium is going to be higher.
I think it can be like pseudo low. Or is this, I
think there's something about hypokalemia. So think back to hyperkalemia treatment, what do you give them? Or bicarb. What does bicarb do? Drives potassium into the cell so that acid can come out, right? Well, what if you have a bunch of acid instead? Acid goes into the cell, potassium comes out, so they can become hyperkalemic. Okay. And so as you fix them, their potassium can change, right? Their potassium shifts back. So, and they'll be dehydrated, so you have to give them volume, you have to give them insulin, and then you have to sort of correct everything. Okay? They'll have pseudo-hyponatremia. Remember? another correction for that is for every 100 that the glucose is over 100, your sodium drops by 2. Okay. So the measured sodium is going to be 2 lower than the actual sodium. So if you have a blood sugar of 600, that's 500 above 100, right? That's 500, so 2 times each of the hundreds, that's 2 times 5 is 10. So the sodium would really be 10 more than what you're measuring on your lab. So if they give you a sodium measurement on your chemistry of 125, their real sodium would be 135 once you correct their hyperglycemia. Okay. So this is one of the ways diabetics die in the acute setting. That's why people are always like, oh my God, that so-and-so is a diabetic and they're wandering off or lost or kidnapped or whatever and they don't have their insulin. Right? They'll get comatose and then die and they can't get insulin. Symptoms are usually pain, dizziness, altered mood and mental status, dehydration, weakness, acidosis, and everything else that goes with it.
What's painful?
They get a lot of cramps everywhere. Like the GI tract hurts, everything hurts. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of belly pain, particularly. Let's see. Okay, and then let's do this one. Acute GI bleeds. Okay. So, how do they usually present?
Acute.
Okay, that's one way. Or hematochezia. So usually with bleeding, right?
Hypovolemia.
Okay.
Yeah. So they might be weak, tired, hypotensive, and bleeding from somewhere. Either they're throwing up blood or they're bleeding down at the bottom. Okay. Or they can have melena. What's more likely, melena or hematochezia? Or do they mean something different?
Acute is probably hematochezia. Melena is the growth through from your small bowel, right?
So what does melena indicate? So you're saying small bowel
bleed.
Can you have hematochezia from a small bowel bleed?
I mean,
so it has to do with transit time. So the reason that you don't get melena from a colon bleed is because there's no time for the blood to sit there and do anything, right? It just comes out. If you bleed in your small intestine, it takes a while to come out. So it can sit there and get processed by all the bacteria and turn dark. Except that a really fast bleed, so it's not a slow like trickle, it's a big vessel that's bleeding fast, fills up your gut, and that blood is cathartic. It'll come out of you quickly. Mm-hmm. And so you can get hematochezia from upper GI bleeds as well. So most common cause of an hematochezia is an upper GI bleed, even though lower GI bleeds are always hematochezia and not melena. Upper GI bleeds that are slow are going to be melena. Upper GI bleeds that are fast are going to be hematochezia. Make sense? If someone presents with an acute GI bleed, what's the first thing you want to do? Well, the first thing you want to do is give them some fluids and volume, right? You want to check and see if they're anemic. Are they likely to be anemic? Why not?
Because it's acute.
Yeah, because you bleed whole blood, right? So the concentration of your hemoglobin doesn't change because you bleed whole blood. They'll be anemic after you resuscitate them. After you give them a bunch of fluid, mm-hmm. and then it equilibrates, and then they are going to be that he. initially they'll be anemic after you resuscitate, and then you have to give them blood to keep up with their ongoing bleeding. Typically, yeah, if you know they're having massive bleeding, you'll just keep giving them blood. You want to make sure that they're on monitored beds, that they're adequately resuscitated as far as blood pressure goes and volume, and yeah, then you want to find the source of the bleeding. Okay. So, what's the best way to find the source of the bleeding? First thing is you want to get their history and find out what their history is. So, is this a cirrhotic patient? Do they have a history of coagulopathy? Do they have any known GI problems like ulcer disease, varices, previous GI bleeds, diverticulosis, tumors in their GI tract, or anything that's known, or recent surgeries or anything? Are they on a bunch of blood thinners? Are they on antiplatelets? Are they taking a bunch of NSAIDs that's likely to cause an ulcer that's like make them bleed? And you also want to look at, where's the blood coming from? Is it likely coming from above or below? Now, upper GI bleeds that are before the pylorus usually present with vomiting blood. But if it's in the duodenum or distal, they may not vomit any blood, because if the pylorus is intact, that blood won't reflux back into the stomach, it'll just go forward. And so they can have hematochezia if it's a brisk bleed, or melena if it's a slow bleed. You go to surgery to fix it. A lot. If their hemoglobin's like 4. What are you going to do in the operating room?
So what?
Can you see inside your intestine?
How much law should I be here?
You can't find the bleeding effectively. So the best thing to do is not go to the operating room first, because you can't find the bleeding source. So the best thing to do is either do endoscopy, if they're stable enough, or angiography. So if you do endoscopy, you go upper or lower and find the source of the bleeding. Upper is easy to do, even if they're bleeding, right? And then you can actually see an ulcer or a bleeding vessel or varices or something. You can clip it or inject it and intervene and try to stop it. And you get the diagnosis and you can actually intervene. Colonoscopy is a little bit more difficult because blood's coming down and you didn't do a prep or anything, right? So GI doctors are like, I gotta prep them. And the answer is no, you don't prep them, because they're bleeding to death. So there's no time to prep, for one. For two, blood is cathartic. The blood is prepping. And three, you're not looking for tiny little polyps. You're looking for massive bleeding. So you just keep going up until you get to a point where there's massive bleeding. And then at least you know the region that the bleeding is in. So you tell me it's in the right colon, I'll take out half the colon. I know I'll get the bleeding. Tell me it's in the colon, I can take out like the entire colon if I have to. But I know it's in the colon, I'm dead. If you can't tell me if it's in the stomach, the esophagus, the small intestine, or the colon, I can't take out the entire colon. The other thing you can do is do angiography. And you do an angiogram of the mesenteric blood vessels. So the celiac, the SMA, and you try to get to their branches and see if there's a vessel that's blushing, which is where it doesn't taper at a capillary, but it just seems like it just bursts into a pool of blood. That usually means that's a blood vessel that oozing into a cavity as opposed to into a capillary. And so they can actually embolize that vessel or mark it with methylene blue, or you know, or at least tell you which vessel it was. They can tell you if it's the SMA or the IMA, is it the right colic or the left colic, is it the off the celiac, is it the gastroduodenal, you know, where is it? And they may be able to even get control of it, but at least you'll know. But the key is you got to find out where it's bleeding from and why.